Welcome to the East County Magazine Live Radio Show, the voice of East County, bringing you the hottest news and coolest events from the communities of San Diego's East County. We're your community radio, representing the public interest, not special interests. Broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso with your host, Miriam Raftery.
This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, recording at our studio in the East County Wellness Center in El Cajon. We open our show today with an international story that hits home hard for many Chaldean American and Assyrian Christians living right here in San Diego and East County. ISIS has executed Christian captives, and the lives of hundreds more are at risk. Hear what religious and human rights leaders around the world are asking the United States to do to save Christians from genocide. If you've ever received wrong information about doctors covered under your health care plan, we've got some good news for you about a new law just signed into law by Governor Jerry Brown. And then from County News Service, we have some disturbing news about a growing outbreak of West Nile virus that has claimed a second life in El Cajon and what you should do to protect yourself and your family. A bill by San Diego Assemblywoman Shirley Weber aimed at reducing racial profiling by police has been signed into law, and we'll have the details on today's show. On our Green Scene report, we have some good news on the conservation front about a permanent extension granted to a local river conservancy organization. Then from Public News Service, learn why childhood obesity rates are actually dropping in some Southern California communities. Here in East County, the family of Elijah Bear Diaz, a 20-year-old missing man with diabetes from El Cajon, believes he did not leave voluntarily. Now they are holding a fundraiser to support their search efforts, and we'll have information on how you can help them bring Bear home. A house fire in Alpine over the weekend has claimed the life of two people. Stay tuned for the tragic details. From Public News Service, we'll have headline news from across the nation, including a growing effort in several states to recognize the accomplishments of Native Americans on what has traditionally been celebrated as Columbus Day. We'll have a preview of Tuesday night's Democratic primary debate, as well as information on the upcoming dedication of a new Cedar Fire Memorial in Lakeside. And then on the second half of our show, as we approach the Halloween season, we have a treat for you today on our bookshelf segment. Raina Menashe interviews David Schmidt, author of Holy Ghost Stories. He'll be telling you his theories about a haunted college in San Diego and sharing a spine-tingling ghost story as well. Later, we'll have information about efforts to secure a scenic highway designation for State Route 52 through the heart of Mission Trails Regional Park. Then on Ready, Set, Grow, Connie Beck will share some water-saving tips for your yard. And finally, on Brewbeat, Ed Barana will share details about a new brew bike bill signed into law by Governor Jerry Brown. So cheers! We'll have all these stories and more, so stay tuned for today's edition of the East County Magazine radio show on KNSJ, where East County matters.
ISIS, the Islamic State, has released a video showing the apparent executions of three Assyrian Christian hostages captured in Syria in February. ISIS militants are threatening to kill 200 more hostages, including women and children, unless hefty ransoms are paid for each prisoner. Multiple major news outlets are now reporting. Assyrian and Chaldean Christians have faced genocide at the hands of ISIS for refusing to convert to Islam. International leaders are urging President Barack Obama and Congress to take action, but thus far, those pleas seem to have fallen on deaf ears. Locally, Mark Arabo, a leader in the Iraqi Chaldean community, issued this statement. It breaks my heart to see the continuous bloodshed and the constant persecution of Christians by ISIS. Scholars, journalists, and the American public are in consensus that more must be done to end this genocide. Yet our government continues to remain inactive. Every video is yet another reminder of the victims our government has left to rot in Iraq and Syria. The Assyrian International News Agency reports that during the three-day assault on Christian villages in Syria, in which the men were kidnapped, churches were burned to the ground, and hundreds of Christians were taken hostage. In August, another 250 Syriac Orthodox and Syriac Catholic families were captured. Those who have escaped tell of schools of death to which they were sent, where men were executed and women and girls turned into sex slaves if they refused to convert to Islam. Thousands have fled the region, creating a refugee crisis unmatched since World War II, but many others have stayed in their homelands where they face potential extermination. A month ago, a resolution was introduced into Congress, House Concurrent Resolution 75, calling on U.S. lawmakers to officially recognize crimes by ISIS against minorities as genocide. Pope Francis has urged the United Nations to come to the protection of these vulnerable communities. Last week, over 100 religious leaders, scholars of genocide, and human rights advocates entreated President Barack Obama to protect Christians and other religious minorities with a declaration of genocide, which would allow the legal weight of the international community to hold perpetrators accountable, also expanding asylum and relief efforts. Kirsten Evans, Executive Director of In Defense of Christians, issued this statement: "Swift moral leadership is needed at all levels of the international community. The international community can no longer drag its feet while ancient and peaceful communities in the Middle East face an existential crisis of genocidal proportion." In Defense of Christians added its voice with many others around the world in calling upon the United States government and the international community to act to defend the defenseless. Evans concludes, "It's time to stop the Christian genocide." Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, the Network for Social Justice, this is Leon Thompson.
This is Miriam Raftery with a health report. A brand new law aims to make insurance companies provide accurate information for consumers in their directories of doctors and other providers. The change comes after many consumers complained that after signing up for health insurance through Covered California, they learned that the health care plans they enrolled in had mistakes, such as doctors listed who were no longer in the network. Covered California discontinued its directory in February. But a state audit also found many errors in directories by major health insurers, including Anthem Blue Cross, Health Net, and Partnership Health Plan, such as wrong phone numbers and addresses, as well as inaccurate information on which doctors were even accepting new patients. Our family experienced this problem personally. One family member needed immediate surgery for a pituitary tumor at the base of the brain, only to discover too late that the surgeon listed in the directory was no longer a covered provider on her plan. She had to pay thousands of dollars out of pocket for the life-saving surgery that she needed. To remedy these ills, Governor Jerry Brown has signed a bill into law sponsored by consumer groups that will require insurers to provide accurate information in their directories starting in July 2016. Consumers are empowered by the bill, which also requires insurance providers to reimburse an enrollee who pays for out-of-network services because of wrong information in a directory. The measure would authorize an insurer to delay payment to a provider if the provider or the provider's group fails to respond to efforts to verify the group's information. The bill did draw opposition from the California Hospital Association and some physician groups. But consumer advocates have likened the bill to truth in labeling requirements for food products purchased in grocery stores. If you have a right to know what's in your cornflakes or canned soup, consumer groups point out, you should surely have a right to know what doctors are or aren't on your health care plan before making a purchasing decision.
This is Leon Thompson with a health alert from East County Magazine. A 73-year-old El Cajon man has died of West Nile virus, the second fatality this year in San Diego County from the mosquito-borne illness. The county confirms that 5 new patients have been infected with West Nile virus, bringing the total number of cases this year to 11. In addition, there are 13 more suspected cases pending confirmation by the California Department of Public Health. The new cases include a patient who was diagnosed after a blood donation last week. 3 of the recently ill West Nile virus patients were hospitalized due to the illness. The disease is on the rise. 254 infected dead birds have been found so far this year, compared with just 41 last year. In addition, 33 batches of infected mosquitoes have been identified by the county, up from just 6 in 2014. Dr. Wilma Wooten, the county public health officer, says, "These unfortunate deaths are a strong reminder that West Nile virus is a potentially deadly disease and is active in our region." She adds, "It's important that the public continue taking precautions to avoid being bitten by mosquitoes which transmit West Nile virus." The county urges everyone to help protect yourselves and others by following these steps. To prevent mosquito breeding, dump out or remove any item inside or outside the home that can hold water, such as a plant saucer, rain gutters, buckets, garbage cans, toys, old tires, and wheelbarrows. Mosquito fish may be used to control mosquito breeding in backyard water sources such as unused swimming pools, ponds, fountains, and horse troughs. Mosquito fish are available free by contacting the Environmental Health Vector Control Program. Protect yourself from mosquito bites that could transmit West Nile virus by staying inside when most mosquitoes are most active at dusk and dawn. Wear long sleeves and pants or use repellent when outdoors. Use insect repellent that contains ingredients such as DEET, picardin, oil of lemon, or eucalyptus. Make sure screens on windows and doors are in good condition and secure to keep insects out. Report dead crows, ravens, jays, hawks, and owls, and green swimming pools to the Environmental Health Vector Control Program by calling 858-694-2888 or emailing vector@sandiegocounty.ca.gov. For more information about West Nile virus, go to San Diego County's Fight the Bite website.
Governor Jerry Brown has signed Assembly Bill 953 into law. The measure, authored by Assemblywoman Shirley Weber, a San Diego Democrat, aims to reduce racial profiling. Specifically, Assembly Bill 953 would establish a racial and identity profiling advisory board and also require local police departments to report data on traffic and pedestrian stops to the state's Attorney General's office. Upon news of the signing, Weber tweeted, hashtag AB953 is now law. Thanks to governor, advocates, my colleagues, and staff, California is now going in a new direction. The measure comes after the high-profile deaths of unarmed black men at the hands of police in Ferguson, Missouri, New York, and other places. Some law enforcement organizations, including the State Fraternal Order of Police and the 65,000-member Peace Officers Research Association of California, had asked Brown to veto the bill, arguing it would create burdensome paperwork requirements for officers that could result in reduced community policing and added costs. Weber has previously stated that the disturbing deaths in recent months have forced us to confront some ugly truths about the persistence of racial bias in law enforcement. She believes that collecting and publishing data required by AB 953 will help shed light on the scope of problems and hold those bad officers and departments accountable, while also finding a set of best practices when law enforcement gets it right. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Liz Albert.
Now it's time for the Green Scene Report, highlighting energy, environmental, and sustainability issues in our community.
This is Leon Thompson with the Green Scene Report. On Saturday, Governor Jerry Brown signed AB 392, making the San Diego River Conservancy a permanent agency. Previously, it was scheduled to dissolve on January 1st, 2020. The bill was authored by Assembly Speaker Tony Atkins from San Diego. She stated, over the past 13 years, the San Diego River Conservancy has time and again established its value in the region. Created in 2002, the Conservancy has overseen over 100 acres of restoration along the river, built or renovated 15 miles of public trails, and acquired over 200 acres of land purchased from willing sellers. Atkins added, this bill extends the San Diego River Conservancy indefinitely, strengthening this resource for generations to come. The San Diego River Conservancy receives federal, state, and local funding. Making the Conservancy a permanent agency is also expected to save money by cutting down on time needed to oversee key projects. Also on hand for the bill signing was former Assemblymember Christine Kehoe, who helped write legislation to establish the San Diego River Conservancy 13 years ago. Kehoe called the 52-mile San Diego River one of California's most significant historic, cultural, and natural resources, adding that making the Conservancy permanent will assure that the state plays an active role in expanding opportunities for the public to have greater access to this important resource.
Childhood obesity rates have dropped over 5 years in Southern California, according to a recent report from Kaiser Permanente. It found obesity rates fell by 1.6% and the number of overweight children decreased by 2.2%. Part of the credit goes to programs such as Activate Whittier, which promotes exercise and healthy eating. Christina Obregon with the Whittier City School District says school cafeterias now offer healthier food.
They have choices on the salad bar that includes the dark green leafy salad mix and cherry tomatoes or sliced cucumbers. The kids have the option to pick and choose.
Activate Whittier Chair Lori Tiffany says the whole idea was born in 2008 after a report showed that the childhood obesity rate had reached 25%. So her group now helps schools and workplaces make changes. For example, Tiffany advises schools to stop selling sugary foods as fundraisers and sponsor events to promote exercise.
So anybody passionate about a healthier community, they have to forge partnerships. They have to build relationships. And then you got to find places where there's political will to make a change.
One such partnership is with Kaiser Permanente, which supports Activate Whittier with a grant. Lowell Solomon, Vice President of Community Health for Kaiser Permanente, says better health for all means spreading the word.
People coming together and realizing that to secure the blessings of health requires more than doctors and hospitals and medical care. It means that we have to work outside of our medical office buildings and our hospitals with partners to address those big conditions that really drive health.
The study looked at medical records for 173,000 children in Orange County. It shows the rate of childhood obesity went from 19.1% in 2008 down to 17.5% in 2013. The CDC says nationally about 17% of children are obese. For Public News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter.
20-year-old Elijah Bear Diaz vanished from his El Cajon home on August 29th. Now his family plans to hold a spaghetti dinner fundraiser and raffle at Barona Clubhouse on October 23, 2015, to raise money for continuing the search. Katie Hoffman, a family friend, told East County Magazine, "Since we believe Bear is not missing on his own terms, the family has hired a private investigator, which these funds will go toward." She's working with Lelaney Thompson, Bear's mother. Bear is a diabetic who left with only enough insulin for a week, missing several doctor's appointments. He had a serious foot injury and was last seen on crutches. A private investigator hired by the family called his disappearance suspicious, NBC News reports. His family remains deeply concerned for his well-being. Bear is 5'10", weighs about 110 pounds, and has brown hair and brown eyes. If you have information about this missing young man, please contact the El Cajon Police Department at 619-579-3311. For information on attending the October 23rd dinner at Barona, you can visit a Facebook page called Bring Bear Diaz Home or check East County Magazine's news site at eastcountymagazine.org. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Leon Thompson.
Two bodies were found by firefighters inside a burned home in the 700 block of South Grade Road in Alpine over the weekend. Firefighters arrived at 1:15 in the morning on Saturday to find the home engulfed in flames. Two people did escape the inferno, suffering minor burns and smoke inhalation, and they were taken to a hospital, 10 News reports. But two others were apparently trapped inside, a man of unknown age and a 43-year-old woman, according to the medical examiner's office, though the cause of death will be determined by an autopsy. The identities of the victims have not yet been released by authorities. A firefighter also suffered minor injuries, according to Alpine Fire's Facebook page. Crews from Alpine and Lakeside Fire Departments, Heartland Fire and Rescue, as well as CAL FIRE responded to the blaze, which briefly spread into nearby trees and bushes before it was finally extinguished. The Sheriff's Bomb Arson Unit is investigating, as is customary whenever a death occurs in a fire. The cause of the fire has not yet been determined.
You're listening to KNSJ, 89.1 FM Descanso, the network for social justice.
Welcome to the Public News Service Daily Newscast for Monday, October the 12th, 2015. I'm Mike Clifford. In focus on our nationwide rundown, we examine the congressional spending bill and whether it puts progress on poverty at risk. Indigenous people demand equal time on Columbus Day. The killing of Cecil Lion shining a spotlight on U.S. trophy hunting. And plenty of moms and dads will be passing them around on holiday road trips, but a new lawsuit challenges the health value of fruit snacks. Topping our news, President Obama says he will stay the course on Syria, telling 60 Minutes we would not reinsert ourselves in a military campaign inside of Syria. The Washington Post notes it was a week ago that Obama signaled the end to the $500 million effort to train Syrian rebels to fight the Islamic State. The administration is now banking on a new plan to provide direct aid to existing rebel units that the Pentagon thinks can beat ISIS. Meantime, a new analysis says the spending bill working its way through Congress could put even modest gains in the fight against poverty at risk.
Poverty in Colorado dropped last year by a single percentage point, but nearly one in six children in the state still live below the poverty line. That's according to new analysis of U.S. Census data conducted by 9to5 Colorado. Bridget Kamenetsky is the group's lead economic security organizer. She says even modest gains are at risk with the current congressional spending bill for 2016. That includes additional cuts to programs with a proven track record for reducing poverty.
Members of Congress need to realize that they have a choice to make. They can either continue to cut and put more people into poverty, or they can stop these cuts so our nation can grow and eliminate poverty.
Kamenetsky says the formula for cutting poverty rates isn't a secret. She points to the Earned Income Tax Credit and Child Tax Credit, which lifted almost 148,000 Coloradans, including 82,000 children, out of poverty each year from 2011 to 2013. She notes that last year, housing subsidies raised nearly 2.8 million Americans out of poverty, with food stamps helping 4.7 million. I'm Eric Galatis.
And groups advocating for the rights of indigenous peoples are celebrating today right alongside Columbus Day. Suzanne Potter tells us the aim is to make a point about American history.
The second Monday in October should be celebrated as Indigenous Peoples Day alongside Columbus Day to better represent the consequences of Columbus's landing in North America. That's the message from a number of groups holding celebrations in Tucson today. There will be events all day long at the University of Arizona, followed by a series of speakers at the Global Justice Center. Jose Matus with the Indigenous Alliance Without Borders says the conventional narrative of Columbus as a hero is misguided.
They say that Columbus discovered America, and they say that he named us Indians. And we say, no, we were not discovered by Columbus or anybody else. Should not be a national holiday. Should not recognize a person that has not been good to the Indian community.
Native American advocates note that Columbus's arrival brought previously unknown diseases to North America, which ravaged the local tribes. And settlers' clashes with the tribes resulted in much bloodshed.
National Indigenous Peoples Day is recognized as a holiday in South Tucson. It was first proposed as a counter-narrative to Columbus Day at a United Nations conference back in 1977. A new poll shows Americans are turning thumbs down on trophy hunting by a 2-to-1 margin. That same poll also sends a clear message about trophy hunting in the U.S. 64% of U.S. voters told a Humane Society of the U.S. poll that they oppose trophy hunting in the United States. And in states like Maine, that usually means bear hunting. Teresa Teleki is Humane Society International's Director of Wildlife.
We know, for instance, that there are thousands and thousands of bears that are killed, I believe, over 3,000 in the state of Maine alone as trophies. And other animals that are hunted as trophies here in the U.S. are mountain lions, wolves, and bobcats.
64% of those responding to the poll also said they oppose canned hunting. That's where animals such as lions are bred and hunted in fenced enclosures for trophies. And finally, does a fruit snack have to contain actual fruit if its packaging indicates as much? As Nia Hamm reports, that's a question at the heart of a lawsuit filed against Welch's Foods by several parents in New York.
They say the snacks are, quote, no more healthful than candy. The suit says the parents bought the snacks as a healthy option for their children based on the labeling, but found the product contains only a minimal amount of fruit and is mostly made of corn syrup and sugar. Marie Bragg with NYU's Global Institute of Public Health says federal regulations give advertisers a lot of leeway when it comes to food labeling.
There's mixed evidence on whether or not turning fruit puree or fruit juice into snacks is healthy for you or not. I think the companies sometimes try to convince consumers that because it's got fruit juice, it's healthy, but that's not necessarily true.
Hunter College professor Charles Platkin says this could be a tricky legal area for Welsh's.
I think that anytime you're marketing to children, a vulnerable population, it increases the level at which the food company's responsibility lands. So I think that yes, Welsh's has vulnerability, as do other food companies that market to children.
Promotion in Motion calls the claims in the lawsuit against Welch's Fruit Snacks false and misleading, and maintains that fruit, whether it's in the form of puree or juice, is always the first ingredient. That's our news for now. Happy Columbus and Indigenous Peoples Day. I'm Mike Clifford for Public News Service, member and listener supported, and online at publicnewsservice.org.
The first debate among Democratic presidential candidates will take place on Tuesday, October 13th, moderated by CNN anchorman Anderson Cooper, with additional questions to be posed by other CNN correspondents. The debate could include as many as six candidates. In addition to the frontrunners, former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton and Senator Bernie Sanders. CNN has indicated that Vice President Joe Biden will be included if he declares his intent to run even as late as the day of the debate. Other Democrats invited to participate are former Massachusetts Governor Martin O'Malley, former Rhode Island Governor Lincoln Chafee, and former Virginian Senator Jim Webb, all considered long shots based on the poll results, averaging just over 1% each. The debate, hosted by CNN and Facebook, will be held in Las Vegas and is set to air on 6 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Tasha Matthews.
A dedication ceremony for the newly completed Cedar Fire Historic Monument will be held on October 24th from 10 to 11 a.m. at the Lakeside Fire Protection Office and Fire Station in Lakeside. The monument includes a pocket park and honors first responders, those lost in the fire, as well as the strength and resilience of survivors. Other elements are a map of the fire, fire-resistant plants, and a symbolic red flagpole. The monument has been designed as a place to inspire people to reflect, reconnect, and remember Lakeside's struggle and rebirth after the Cedar Fire. Supervisor Diane Jacob will participate in the dedication, along with Lakeside Fire District's Board of Directors, the Cedar Fire Monument Committee, contractors, donors, and sponsors who dedicated their time, equipment, supplies, and labor to build the park. The Cedar Fire burned over 280,000 acres, 2,800 buildings, and killed 15 people, including a firefighter, before being contained on November 3, 2003. It still ranks as the largest and deadliest wildfire in California history. For more information, you can visit lakesidefire.com.
This is KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, in the heart of San Diego's East County.
The East County Magazine Show on KNSJ Radio is produced by the nonprofit Heartland Coalition. We're your community news. We reflect your interest, not special interest. You can get involved by volunteering, get trained to be a citizen journalist, and support East County Magazine at www.eastcountymagazine.org. And you can send your news tips and story ideas to editor@eastcountymagazine.org. Now stay tuned for part two of the East County Magazine radio show. The East County Magazine show airs Mondays and Fridays on KNSJ from 5 o'clock to 6 o'clock p.m. You can listen live at 89.1 FM or online at knsj.org. You can also listen anywhere by downloading the TuneIn application for your smartphone. For details, visit tunein.com.
Welcome to Bookshelf, bringing you stories of local literary luminaries and some great books to read. My name is Raina Menashe, and I'll be your host for this segment. Today I'm speaking with David J. Schmidt. He is an East County author of the new book, Holy Ghosts, True Tales from a Haunted Christian College. My guest is also the author of two humorous romance parody novels, Pirates of the Danube and The Baron Rides Again. And he has also co-authored The Daily Book of Art and The Daily Book of Photography. Welcome, David. It's a pleasure having you on Bookshelf.
Thank you, Raina. It's a pleasure to be here.
Let's begin with your new book. I understand that it's a paranormal story taking place in San Diego, which is perfect for Southern Californian Halloween. And your book describes Point Loma Nazarene University as filled with poltergeists and apparitions. Tell us what's haunting this local university and why we should take these stories seriously.
That's right. Well, my book is a collection of nonfiction stories, almost all of them firsthand accounts that I've collected from people who have worked at Point Loma, who've studied there. And it's a collection of all these stories involving ghosts, poltergeists, strange things happening. Mm-hmm. As far as who's haunting Point Loma, the easiest answer to say is Madame Tingley. Now, Madame Tingley, mm-hmm. Catherine Tingley was her name. She built the campus more than 100 years ago. She was in charge of the Theosophical Society, and they were a group of occultists. They believed in combining the ancient traditions of different religions from around the world. They believed in searching for ancient mysteries. Mm-hmm. And according to some rumors, Madame Tingley was into some darker stuff, too.
Ah.
According to some of the stories, they say she used to hold seances at what is now the campus of Point Loma Nazarene, back when it was housed the Theosophical community. They say that she would sit in her house with people, sit around a table, call up the spirits. Newspapers from the time, they describe her as a spirit medium and a fine trance reader. And most of the stories center around what used to be her house. Now, that building is now called Cabrillo Hall. It's mm-hmm. on the campus. It's used for classrooms, and it houses offices. But back in the day, that was Madame Tingley's house. And Cabrillo Hall, it's built with a very unique architecture. In fact, when you walk inside, you look, and the stairs are very tiny on Madame Tingley's house, Cabrillo Hall. It has very tiny steps on the staircase going to the second floor. According to rumor, the reason for that is that she wanted to be reincarnated as a cat or a turtle, and she wanted to come back and haunt her own house as ghost cat or ghost turtle. And now, obviously, a turtle's not the scariest thing in the world, but many students and security guards are afraid to go in there at night, get a weird feeling in there at night. And I've collected stories from students going all the way back to the 1970s and 80s. One student was in there working with classmates late at night when they heard a moaning coming from a closet door that was locked. Another group of students were in there late at night when they saw banging on the windows, heard the windows being banged on, saw the windows vibrating, but nobody was anywhere nearby. And so most stories center around Cabrillo Hall, Madame Tingley's house. But many of the stories center around places that don't have that much history behind them either. Some of the dorm rooms, the theater on campus, which are newer buildings, they have stories associated with them as well. As for the question of why to take these stories seriously, the simplest answer is that the sources are reliable. The people I've talked to, most of them are very skeptical-minded people, mm-hmm. skeptically-minded people. Some of them grew up and went on to become police officers, military personnel, the type of really analytical, mm-hmm. right-brained thinker-type folks mm-hmm. who you would not think of as either superstitious or suggestible in any way.
Interesting. So without spoiling anything, could you tell us why, maybe? Did you get any sense of why she is haunting this place?
Well, a lot of the stories go back to the Theosophists and their history on campus. As far as why this campus in particular and why does it accumulate this kind of activity,
right?
I believe that that's a mystery. I don't think anyone understands something like a haunting. And that's what makes my perspective unique from a lot of other folks who write about ghosts. In general, when you talk about ghosts, I divide most folks out there into two categories. There's two extreme ends of the spectrum. So one end is what I call the Scooby-Doo approach. And at the other end, it's the Ghostbusters approach. So the Scooby-Doo approach is people who say flat out, there cannot be such a thing as ghosts or hauntings or anything of what we would call paranormal. And you know how that's how every mm-hmm. episode of Scooby-Doo ends. Mm-hmm. They get to the end and
right.
it turns
out
it was a prank the whole time uh-huh. or, you know, what they thought was a ghost. It was just a sheet hung over a chair. And they say, oh, it was old man Spunkers from the abandoned amusement park the whole time.
Right.
And I would have gotten away with it if it wasn't for you kids. And so a lot of people think that way. They think that our science and our understanding of the universe, it's already absolute and it's perfect and we understand how things work. So anything that falls outside of our understanding, it must be superstition or misunderstanding or someone's imagination. Now, the Ghostbusters approach, that's like a lot of these professional ghost hunters you see on mm-hmm. TV with their equipment. And that's the belief that ghosts exist and that we understand how they work, that we know what they're made of, that we can detect them, we can record them with our devices. And I don't know if that's totally accurate either, because if ghosts are real, and I believe that they are in some sense, they're a mystery. I mean, that's why we call it paranormal in the first place. If we understood how it worked, we wouldn't call it paranormal. It would just be normal activity if we understood what they were made of, how to
right.
record them.
Right. So what is your critical approach to analyzing the whole topic?
Well, this book is for people who are not really sure what they think about ghosts.
Okay.
It's for a lot of those folks who are in that middle ground who
don't
right, who don't fall into either the Scooby-Doo approach or the Ghostbusters approach. For people like myself, I'd put myself in that category. People who believe in the possibility of a haunting happening, of something from the past remaining in a place, but don't claim to understand how that works. And I think that's the healthiest approach to go from.
Oh, I see.
I think it's silly to assume that our science has already discovered everything there is to be discovered. But I think it's equally silly to assume that ghosts are something we can study and understand with our technology in the status it's in right now. And we just think about technology and science and where it was 100 years ago, right. 300 years ago, all the things that science had no idea even were existed.
Sure.
And so in my book, I look at these stories. I do take them seriously because I believe the people who've told them to me, they're very trustworthy sources,
mm-hmm.
Without claiming to have a bottom line understanding of what exactly is going on or why these things are happening. But
right.
with that being said, I go through a lot of different theories. I go through a lot of critical approaches and theories to hauntings and to ghosts based on my research and what I've looked into about how we might understand this phenomenon that essentially is a mystery to us humans at this time. One of those theories has to do with quantum theory, the idea that the past and the present are next to each other, are parallel mm-hmm. in parallel dimensions, and sometimes those dimensions bleed into each other.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes we might see glimpses of the past, catch a figure, a sound from a past moment that has mm-hmm. bled over into the present. Another theory is as far as poltergeist activity. A lot of researchers believe that that's not because of something from the past at all, but it's because of a present human being who is undergoing emotional stress, and that stress finds an outlet
mm-hmm.
in what we call telekinetic ability. Now, telekinesis, it's a theoretical idea. Nobody's proven that it exists. There are some scientific experiments that I cite in the book that mm-hmm. I looked into that show mild evidence that it might exist. But the theory is that some people have telekinetic abilities, but they unconsciously use them. So they make objects move around. The movie Carrie is the most extreme case of that. You know, the main mm-hmm. character, she can cause cars to explode, which would be great if you were getting bullied at school. Unfortunately, nobody's figured out how to control it that
right.
way. And which is probably a good thing.
Yeah.
But that theory is that poltergeist activity is caused by a human, not by a ghost or spirit from the past. And another theory is that the past has a way of imprinting onto certain places, especially when there's strong emotions involved. Those moments from the past that can be very traumatic or emotional, they stick to a place. They imprint on that place through a process that we don't understand, but might be very similar to photographic technology, to audio mm-hmm. recording. And that theory says that certain buildings hold on to moments of the past and continue to replay them on loop, that some people, for whatever reason,
that's an interesting theory,
can tap into.
Yeah. So maybe it's a way to connect us with the past so that it's part of our actual experience today.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And in fact, one researcher, Peter Underwood, he's from Great Britain. He writes about ghosts a great deal. He suggests that by observing ghosts and hauntings, we recharge that recording. So if nobody was there to watch it, mm-hmm. according to his theory, it might eventually fade away and disappear, almost like an old cassette tape that with mm-hmm. time it deteriorates and falls apart. But he suggests that by observing, we feed into it and we recharge those memories that the place holds onto.
Now, you got your BA from Point Loma Nazarene. So did you ever catch hint of any of these happenings or ghosts?
Yeah, I've had a few experiences there. Nothing as dramatic as looking Madame Tingley in the eye, although I did do that eventually in a more abstract sense. At the end of my book, I talk about meeting modern-day theosophists and meeting the modern-day equivalent of the community that used to be at Point Loma. But I never saw her ghost. I did have some experiences, though. I took my cousin and some friends of hers to visit the campus after I had graduated, and they wanted to do some ghost hunting. So we went. I told them the stories behind the places. Mm-hmm. And we got to the theater eventually, which has a story about the ghost lamp and about the ghost Irving in there who makes the lamp explode when somebody mocks the ghost. So we went to the theater. They wanted to see the inside, but it was really late. We tried the front doors. They were locked. We went to try one side entrance. As soon as we walked around the side, the light overhead us turned off, and it's not a motion sensor light. Mm-hmm. And I said, that's odd, but it's probably a coincidence.
Mm-hmm.
We went around to the other side where there's some wooden steps leading up to a side entrance. And I said, let me try this door. You know, maybe it's unlocked. I went up to check the door, and I tried it. It was locked. So I turned back and I told my cousin, okay, I guess it's time for us to go. And right as I said that, I heard the doorknob jiggle, go back and forth.
Really?
And I booked it down those steps and I ran off and my cousin made fun of me and called me a coward. But then she showed me that she had taken a picture of me right before that happened, standing on the steps to that side entrance. And in the picture, you see this faint little white glowing orb or ball of light behind me with almost a trail like it's coming up behind me. And I don't put too much stock in ghost photography and orbs. Uh-huh. But the weird thing is that that photo was taken right before the doorknob jiggled.
And wow. Did she hear the doorknob jiggle?
Oh, we saw it jiggle. All three of us, me and her friend, all three of us saw the doorknob move back and forth physically. Mm-hmm. And we knew that nobody was inside the theater at the time. And plenty of my fellow students, classmates also, and people who worked at the college, they all told me these stories when I was a student there. And that was where the idea for this book came from, because I started realizing that this is one unique place that has this huge accumulation of ghost stories about it. And it seemed anybody who spent enough time there eventually had some strange experience that they'd gone through. And as I mentioned, even really critically minded, skeptical people, like my brother, he went on to be a military man and a police officer. Mm-hmm. At the time he was when he was a student, he was a public safety officer, a security guard. And he went into Cabrillo Hall, Madame Tingley's old house. He went in there for the first time. He had heard the stories. He had heard from other security officers that they got weird feelings being in there, didn't like being in that building alone at night. And so he was kind of excited. He went in there for the first time when he had to do building checks. And he's in the building, and he suddenly hears this music, really faint minor key violin music playing. Well, he figured it's probably a radio somewhere. So he decided he'd try to figure out where the music was coming from. Mm-hmm. He moved over to different sides of the building. Everywhere he was, it seemed like the music was all around him. Next, he figured, well, somebody left a radio on. They left their computer playing music. So he checked all the radios on both floors of the building. Everything's turned off. All the appliances are unplugged. So then he went down to the basement to check down there.
Never go down to the basement.
Yeah, that's a horror movie 101. Never go down to the basement. But he goes down. Nowadays, the basement has some art classrooms in it, some art studios. Uh-huh. So he goes down in there, and it's creepy, and he's all alone with these linoleum floors, and there are these mannequins lying around that look like dead bodies in the dark light. And so he's creeped out, but he checks the basement. And finally, he goes into one of these art studios, and he finds this big stereo sitting in the middle of the studio. He thinks, oh, man, I found it. So he walks up to the stereo and he starts to laugh to himself. Like I was freaked out. I was afraid of nothing. And there's this stereo here. And he walks over to get a closer look. And then he sees that it's unplugged and the battery cover's hanging open. There's no batteries and it's not turned on. And he can still hear that music.
And it was coming from the radio.
It was not coming from the radio. It was all around him.
Okay. Well, this makes me want to go to the university and check it out myself.
Right.
Now, is Point Loma Nazarene University, is that on the ghost tour of San Diego, you know, the 100 most haunted places?
Right. No, it's not. It's not part of that. And in fact, this is the first book that's ever been written about Point Loma Nazarene's ghosts. None of the books, there's several books out there about San Diego's ghosts. Most of them focus on Old Town. They focus on the Hotel Del and some of the other more famous haunted places. But Point Loma's not in any of those books.
Wow.
It's one of the lesser-known haunted spots.
Well, maybe the ghosts like that better.
I suppose. Maybe they like the solitude.
Now, David, I know that you're very well-traveled also. You speak multiple languages, nine?
Right.
You speak nine officially. Languages. And how is traveling to so many countries and hearing stories from around the world, and how has that piqued your interest in the paranormal?
Well, if anything, it's convinced me that there's more out there that we don't understand than what we do understand. The more countries I've been to, and I've visited a lot of countries, have lived abroad. I currently spend about half the year in Mexico and half the year here in San Diego. I lived in Russia for a while. And if that's taught me anything, it's taught me how much mystery there is, how little of the world we really understand. A lot of us have this hubris about us, and we claim to understand how the world works. And again, that Scooby-Doo mentality of wanting mm-hmm. to subject everything to our perception of the natural mm-hmm. world, how we perceive it works. And the more you travel and the more you talk to people from different cultures, the more you realize that that's just one worldview. It's one cultural viewpoint out of many that are out there. Now, a lot of people, skeptical people, would say anything that sounds strange or paranormal or ghostly it must just be superstition. It's because somebody mm-hmm. was raised with these beliefs and they're going to see what they mm-hmm. expect to see. Now, I think that can definitely happen. And sure. I've met people who are superstitious and who are suggestible, and they're not the type of people that I usually cite in the stories that I collect and mm-hmm. write about, because I don't think they're reliable sources. But I've met the opposite also. I think that it's possible to be suggestible and to be predisposed to see something if you are superstitious and believe in it. But I think it's equally possible to be predisposed to not see something if you have this prejudice that that thing does not exist. If right. you follow a strict prejudice that only the natural world, as I understand it, exists, well, that can blind you to things that may be there the whole time that you may not want to see or not be prepared to see.
Very interesting. Food for thought there. So in honor of Halloween, what is the creepiest brief tell that you can tell us right now? Is there one that you can tell us?
Well, one of my favorite is from Point Loma. It involves a security guard back in the 1970s. And this, it involves Madam Tingley's house, which anyone can, the campus you can visit, just ask for a visitor's pass at the guard shack and you can visit the campus and see her house for yourself. It's this old two-story white Victorian style house. So this security guard, he's checking the house out one night. And they say this happened back in the 1970s. This was back when the house was located at a different part of campus. Mm-hmm. And in the 1980s, they dismantled the house and relocated it to the place where it stands today. Mm-hmm. But back then, it was located where the music building is. Cooper Music is located now. So he's walking through the house at night alone, and he's feeling a little creeped out. He's walking, he's checking the whole place to make sure that nobody's in there, make sure everything is in its place. He walks up those tiny steps that Madam Tingley had built for herself. And he's on the second story. He's up there and he hears a woman scream. And he thinks, oh my gosh, somebody's in trouble. Somebody needs help. So he calls out, who's there? Can I help you? And he runs down the steps and he thinks somebody's hurt. So he's asking, who's there? Who's there? Hello. And nobody's right. answering him. He checks every room on the first floor. It's silent. Nobody's in there. He checks the room underneath where he was when he heard this voice screaming. Nobody's in there. The carpet's been freshly vacuumed. There's no footprints in it. And he's thinking, what the heck is going on? He's about to leave, and he turns to leave, and then he hears the voice screaming, and she's still coming from underneath his feet. And he thinks, somebody's in the basement. Somebody's trapped down
there. Basement.
So he's got to go to the basement. Again, never go to the basement.
Never go.
And so he walks out the front doors to the building, and he walks around to the side steps, the stone staircase, leading down to the basement. He pulls out his key ring, and he finds that one old skeleton key that opens mm-hmm. up the basement. And he has to sort of shoulder the door open, just like those cops in the movies do. Uh-huh. And he turns on his flashlight. The basement's silent. It's all still. He's shining his beam around, and there's cobwebs and dust, and there's just a bunch of old tools, boxes stored down there. Back then, nobody ever went down there. They didn't have art studios down there back then. So he's walking through the basement. He's jumping as he sees the shadows, and he thinks he sees monsters and ghosts, but it's just tools and boxes. Nobody's down there at all. He sees the dust on the floor. There's no footprints. So he turns to leave. He figures, well, whatever. Who knows? I don't know why I heard that. Turns off his flashlight, turns toward the door, and then he hears the voice screaming again, and it's still coming from underneath his feet. Now he's in the basement. There's nothing under the basement. So he just runs. He drops his flashlight. It shatters. He runs out. He runs back to public safety headquarters, and nobody believes him. They all make fun of him. They tell mm-hmm. him he's going crazy. Mm-hmm. And they poke fun of him for months after that, and then they forget about it. And they forget this story until a couple of years later when they dismantled the building and they moved it across campus to where it stands today. So they took it apart piece by piece all the way down to the basement. When they got to the wooden floorboards of the basement, as the story goes, they pulled up those wooden floorboards. They find a human skull lying in the earth underneath the basement.
Wow.
Lying face up with its mouth open like it was screaming for all eternity.
And it was a woman.
And according to the story, it was a woman. Now, again, that's how the story goes. But did it actually happen? Well, to find that out, you're going to have to read my book, Holy Ghosts, True Tales from a Haunted Christian College.
Well, that's great. You're quite the storyteller. One last question before I let you go. What are you working on next? Will it be more scary stories or something else?
Absolutely. I have a whole series of scary stories I'm working on right now. It's the Tiny Staircase series, named after Madam Tingley's staircase in Cabrillo Hall. This is a series of short ebooks that I'm putting out on Amazon. They're all available on Amazon and on my website, which is holyghoststories.com. Holyghoststories.com is my website. And you can find the newest installations in the Tiny Staircase series on the website. If you go there, you can also find out how to get a free ebook, one of the books in the Tiny Staircase series, which is called Ghosts Recordings from the Past, which goes into that theory of the past imprinting on places. So over the next few months in the future, I'll be releasing more and more installments in that series, the Tiny Staircase series. I'm also working on a book about my search for the little people legends in Mexico, the little people known as the Duendes or the Chaneques in Mexico. This book will be Into the Chaneques Cave, and it will tell the story of my going into a cave where they say these mysterious, legendary little people live in the mountains of Oaxaca in southern Mexico. And so that book will be coming out sometime next year, Into the Chaneques Cave.
Great.
And then more and more ebooks about ghosts, hauntings, and all these mysteries that surround us. Again, I believe that there's much more that we don't understand than what we do understand.
Wow. Well, we look forward to seeing them. Our time is up, David, but thank you so much for joining us, and happy Halloween.
Happy Halloween to you. Happy Halloween, and happy Dia de los Muertos to everyone out there.
Again, for more information on David J. Schmidt and his work, please visit his website at holyghoststories.com. Again, this is Raina Menashe, and you have been listening to East County Magazine's Bookshelf, bringing you stories of local literary luminaries and some great books to read.
Now it's time for the Green Scene Report, highlighting energy, environmental, and sustainability issues in our community.
This is Ed Barena with East County Magazine's Green Scene Report. Caltrans is considering whether or not to grant state scenic highway designation to State Route 52 from Mass Boulevard in Santee to Santo Road in San Diego. This is where the highway passes through Mission Trails Regional Park and Mission Gorge with its towering cliffs and river valley. The organization Preserve Wild Santee began seeking the designation in 2012, and the San Diego City Council passed a unanimous resolution in support in 2013, yet Caltrans has not taken action thus far. Another organization, Save Mission Trails, along with Preserve Wild Santee, are both asking the public to send letters urging support of the scenic highway designation to preserve the natural beauty of this area from projects such as the Quail Brush gas-fired power plant proposal recently withdrawn by the developer following overwhelming community opposition. Save Mission Trails has provided a sample letter that you can sign and send to the Caltrans director and other decision makers. You can view it at savemissiontrails.org. You can also learn more at Preserve Wild Santee's Facebook page.
This is Miriam Raftery with the Daily Weather Report. After the weekend's record-breaking heat, some relief is in sight. Cooler temperatures are forecast starting Tuesday, with a chance of thunder showers in the afternoons and evenings this week, starting Monday night and continuing throughout the week in East County's mountain and desert areas. Gusty winds increases fire danger, however, so please use caution and avoid activities that can increase the risk of sparks igniting dry brush.
This is Connie Beck with Ready, Set, Grow. I'm going to help you create healthy and beautiful gardens using less money, less hard work, and much more fun. I just came from a client's house where we spent almost all of our time talking about how she needs to change her watering. When I asked her, "How often do these sprinklers come on?" she said, "Every day." And I said, "Oh my goodness." And I said, "What's your motivation in having me here today? What is it that you need us to talk about?" And she says, "I'm spending so much money on water, and it doesn't really pay for itself because I'm not getting the kind of fruit I want, and my plants don't look that great." So I thought this would be a great thing to talk about. Most of us overwater, and in overwatering, that really means we're probably watering much too shallow and much too often. Here, it's hot, and the sun beats down on the soil, and it dries out the soil, and then the roots get dried out, and then the plant suffers. How do we change that? Well, we change it by not watering every day, every other day, every third day. What we want to do is possibly not even change the mechanics of how we're watering. We just want to go to the time clock and change the timing. If you're watering for 5 minutes every day, you would do much better for your plants to water 20 minutes every fourth day, and then possibly even stretch it out from there with a few other tricks I'll tell you.
But the main thing to understand is, if you are watering every day for just a few minutes, then what's happening is the roots are only going to grow where the water is, in the top 4 to 5 to 6 inches of soil. And in that depth, there is no resistance built in for when the Santa Anas come, for when it gets to be past the 4th of July and it's 100 degrees in East County or higher. Those poor plants have to depend on where their roots have grown in that surface area of the soil. So what happens when you change that? What happens is that the more water you give, the less frequently, the further down the roots will go. So if you can train your plant roots by watering correctly, the roots will grow down deeper. They will withstand our heavy, heavy winds and that beating down sun of midsummer, and your plants will be much healthier and much happier. This is especially true of plants that come that are either native here, which you hardly ever water, or the plants that most of us use, the Mediterranean type plants. These are plants that are used to going a while between waterings. Your citrus trees, people come to me and say their citrus isn't doing very well. It looks kind of funny. I say, how often are you watering? Every other day. Okay, that's the problem. You don't even have to go look to find out what the problem is. What you need to do is water your citrus between maybe once a week. If it's a big old tree and it's been in a long time, every couple of weeks, maybe every 3 weeks. I have a lemon tree on my property that we water religiously in June, July, August, and September, once each month. But when we water it nice and deep. We water it so that the water goes down at least 2 feet deep. Makes a huge difference. And then the other thing that we're going to do with our watering issue is we're going to mulch everything. But that's something I'll talk about in another one of these episodes.
The East County Magazine Show airs Mondays and Fridays on KNSJ from 5 o'clock to 6 o'clock p.m. You can listen live at 89.1 FM or online at knsj.org. You can also listen anywhere by downloading the TuneIn application for your smartphone. For details, visit tunein.com.
This is Ed Barena with a Brewbeat report. San Diegans who frequent the downtown area are likely very familiar with pedicabs. These passenger vehicles, which are truly green using human power to pedal the cab, can be a great alternative to walking or taking a traditional cab. They are usually a tricycle frame with a large bench seat for passengers, and now, thanks to a bill signed into law by Governor Jerry Brown, those passengers may be able to drink beer while riding, according to the Sacramento Bee. The so-called Brew Bikes Bill stipulates that pedicabs with up to 15 passengers may allow for beer consumption by passengers while riding. There are some limits on which cabs are permitted for beer. In addition to the age limit for alcohol consumption, a safety officer must be on board, and the Brew Bikes will only be present in cities where the local code allows for the practice. Governor Brown signed the bill, then boarded a pedicab with his wife and dogs along with other lawmakers for a ride around the Capitol. It is unclear when the Brew Bikes will begin servicing the downtown area, but they are likely to be a popular attraction, especially in a craft beer-loving community like San Diego.
This concludes today's episode of East County Magazine's radio show. We extend our appreciation to the East County Wellness Center for our studio space, to the Heartland Coalition, our parent nonprofit, and to KNSJ 89.1 FM, broadcasting from the heart of East County and Descanso. We extend our appreciation to our sound technicians, Leon Thompson and Ed Barena, and to our producer, Miriam Raftery. We also thank the musicians who provided music for our show, Laura Preble, Jim Hannibal, Corey Clement, Giovanni Galicia and the Smashing Beats, Donnie Gentile, Wooden Ambulance, Dusty Summer Road, A.K. Jules, Brian Boykel, Royalty Free Music, Frank Nora, Kevin McLeod, April's Dance from the Smart Sound Solo Simplicity Collection, and Turco, Nomads of the Silk Road. We also thank the County of San Diego for a community enhancement grant to support our Destination East County segment. If you have story ideas or would like to underwrite the East County Magazine radio show, please contact editor@eastcountymagazine.org or call 619-698-7617. We'll be back soon for another edition of East County Magazine's radio show.